My name's Connor. I'm an alcoholic.
Bye, Connor. We love you, Connor. Lots and lots and lots.
How much?
I love you too. Maybe you'll bow your head and pray with me. God help me. Amen. Because that's what it's been about, sobriety. I've been sober since the 1st of January, 2012. Hey. Like it said, I'm a young person in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 23 years old, and I was 17. I was scared to death when I walked in the rooms for the first time. And I have a home group. It's the Durango Young People's Group in Durango, Colorado. We meet Tuesday, Friday, and Saturday at 6 p.m. And as it was said, I actually moved out of Durango this month, and I won't move to Louisville till August. So I'm kind of homeless, which I was telling John from Des Moines. It's different than I remember homeless being when I was drinking, but it's not as bad. And I'm grateful and, as always, honored to show up for the program Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm grateful to the people who came before me and made it possible, because I was a broken shell of a human when I walked in the doors. And I'm also grateful to Faraji and Kayla, Scott, Mike, and everyone who helped put this conference on. It's a smaller conference, but I'm not sure I've ever seen a conference executed with such professional planning and practice, and so great job. Could we give a hand to that? So I was born and I grew up in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, one of the only towns mentioned in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, no big deal. Like Mike was saying, I'm humble. I thought I was their claim to sobriety fame, but then I found out it was in the big book, so rather disappointed when I found that out. But that's also where I got sober. And so I was telling someone today I had a normal childhood, if you will. Depending on your definition of normal, there was a lot of dysfunction, but it could have been worse, right? And the thing is, you know, I had a dad, he's great, you know, who's worked on himself a lot. He was maybe a little heavy-handed with me when I was younger. A mom who, you know, she's also worked on herself. And, you know, ultimately, at the end of the day, the only person I can control is me, you know. And nothing that happened to me in my life, you know, in a perfect world, bad things wouldn't happen to us, right? You know, I was younger, I had a number of experiences that I thought were traumatic. I watched my mom get beat up by the police. You know, my dad, he was a bit abusive. But at the end of the day, I never worried about having a place to sleep or having food to eat. And I lived with a great deal of privilege, and I didn't recognize that until Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a new pair of glasses, because my problem was always you. You know, my problem was always the world around me. It was the things that had happened to me, you know, and those were distractions from what was truly my problem. Because alcohol, like it said in the rooms, like it said in the book, alcohol was but a symptom. And so I had to get down to the causes and conditions of my malady, which needed a spiritual solution. And I'll just cut right to the chase, the first sip of alcohol, because that's, you know, nothing mattered before that to me, you know, at a time in my life. And I was 12, maybe 13 years old, and I had a friend, Tyler, come over, and we didn't know what we were doing, so we drank a whole bottle of Jose Cuervo tequila, and yeah, ugh. That's all right, wouldn't stop me from doing it again, but yeah, but you know, I got sick, I puked all over my parents' house, Tyler did, followed suit, you know. There was a moment in the 20 minutes I was drunk before I started throwing up where I was sitting there like a 12-year-old might do, who's intoxicated, and I was pouring this aerosol spray on my hand and catching it on fire and, yeah, you know, giggling, and I stopped, and I thought to myself, I have arrived. You know, this is this aerosol spray, you know, this is it for me. And I don't know what I had felt before that, when the restlessness, irritability, and discontentedness that my alcoholism is, I don't know when that came about, but I know that in that moment, I had arrived, and I felt alive. And I actually had a thought in that moment, it's funny how true it would be, that I want to feel this way all the time. And for the next 5 years of my life, that's what I did, all the time. And I would go to some pitiful lengths to make sure that that was the case. And, well, of course, I threw up all over the house. And my mom blamed Tyler when she found us, which was, you know, the beginning of that toxic relationship for the next 5 years. And, you know, that actually gave me a message. Oh, it's his fault. And if I can just spin the story to make it their fault and take the attention away from me, well, I can get away with anything. And, you know, I tried a number of things over the years. Yoga, military school, rehab, wilderness programs, jail. You know, it was mentioned I'm going to law school. I will go on these tangents, but bear with me. You know, on Monday, when I get back, I'll be in court. And I'll be in court as a clerk, because I work as a law clerk. And so I'll be on the bench on the opposite side of where I used to sit. And when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been arrested for 8 felonies and 14 misdemeanors. And had I not had that level of privilege that I mentioned, my outcome probably would have been very different. And we never know the details that get us where we are. And I, in sobriety, had to give up on trying to figure out those details. You know, I think about the history of AA. And the man who sponsored Ebby from the Oxford group happened to be treated by Dr. William Silkworth, who's mentioned in the book. And had that man not been turned away by the first two doctors he went to for treatment of his alcoholism, he would have never been pointed to the Oxford group. And Ebby may have never been sponsored. And Bill may have never met him. And we may not be standing here. And so the details that got my life to where they are, I believe, are God-given. And the things that have happened to me, good and bad, because there has been much good in my life, and there's been some bad. The things that have gotten me here, I cannot afford to try and figure out why it is. Why me, you know, when my friend relapses, overdoses, and dies. I don't spend time thinking about that. I stay grateful that I have the seat here today. And I was talking with that same friend earlier today. For every day I've stayed sober, the path has gotten narrower. And especially now, I've been sober about 5 years, a little over 5 years. And no one I got sober with is still around, you know? Actually, one of the people I got sober with has about 2 weeks. And others are dead. And some are dead from this disease, and some are dead by their own hand. And the only difference, you know, I had a friend, Joe. Joe was a family friend who killed himself 2 years ago, and Joe was suffering from this thing. And he reached a point where he could no longer go on drinking and no longer go on not drinking. And he shot himself. And the only difference between someone like me and Joe is that he pulled the trigger. Because everything he's felt up until the moment he did, I've felt in my life. And thanks to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't have to feel those things today. And I get to show up like those who came before me did and try to help others feel that way as well. Because the sense of relief I was looking for, I found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. The things I chased, the things I tried to fill my God-shaped hole with, would take me pretty low. And so back to the story, I guess, now that I'm on this tangent. So I progressed, right? You know, high school, kicked out of, you know, I dropped out of high school. That's another miracle of the program, is that you can go from a high school dropout, being homeless at 16, having nothing, to having a life that, while it's not perfect, it's not full of riches, is respectable and is decent and fills me in the ways that I need to be fulfilled today. And so I left high school in 2010. I was expelled from high school in 10th grade, and I never went back. And I really use that as an excuse to ramp up my drinking. And that's really when it took off. And so it talks about in the big book that maybe you don't have to go to the depths that some of us went. And what I'll say tonight is my experience, and maybe I'll accidentally drop some opinions. But the thing that I want to encourage everyone in the room to do is live your own experience, because my story won't be yours. And your story won't be mine. And I've lived in sobriety trying to live someone else's story, thinking that if I could just be like them, if I could just have their story, maybe the happiness will come to me through osmosis. It didn't work that way. And so I was in and out of jail for about 18 months. And one story I always like to tell, because I feel like it really signifies the type of moral bankruptcy that I was dealing with, is the day my brother graduated high school. Something I never got to do. It was June 11th, 2011, and I hadn't been in contact with my family unless I needed something in quite some time, probably the better part of a year, unless it was to get bailed out of jail, maybe break into my dad's house occasionally and try to steal some money from him, things like that, right? You know, I slept on couches, I did whatever. You know, I remember the way I was looked at when I was digging for food in a dumpster behind this grocery, and the grocery clerk comes out of the store and makes eye contact with me, and it wasn't necessarily a look that I was inhuman, but that's how I felt, because I could tell that the clerk was scared. You know, the ironic part is how scared I was, how fear drove me to do everything I did, and that what I thought was chasing a drunk or a high, you know, chasing whatever, was actually me running. It was me running from Connor, because, you know, one is too many and a thousand is never enough, as it's said, right? And once that train starts rolling, the freight train brain, you know, watch out, because it's a steam engine moving full speed ahead. And so my brother's graduating college. Or, no, he never did that. He's graduating high school. And, sorry, I get my facts mixed up sometimes. Just ask my sponsor. And, So, the alcohol runs out about 10 o'clock. I was an unwelcome guest to start with. And for most 18, 17-year-old kids, that is fine. But for me, it was an issue. And so I just did what I always did and went down the road and broke into the neighbor's house. And they were home, which didn't really matter to me. And for some reason, I wanted to get to the top story of the house. I think I wanted to get beer out of the fridge or whatever, right? And I'm going through this house, and I'm on the second floor. And someone wakes up. And so I hide in this laundry room. And this laundry room, probably it would fit this podium, but it wouldn't fit the table. And I can hear this person coming down the hall, turning lights on and turning lights off, going in the room and checking who's in there. And I know that this room is next from the sketchy, you know, architectural layout I had in my head. And so I had this beer bottle in my hand. And without a thought, I knew that that beer bottle was going to be a weapon if it needed to be in their home. And that is a moment that sticks out to me. I'm not sure why it sticks out to me, because, like I said, I had a number of issues, especially issues with the criminal justice system. But it sticks out to me because in that moment, the spiritual bankruptcy that it talks about in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, moral bankruptcy was complete. I cared nothing about anyone or anything around me. And I would go beyond just ruining my own life or the life of my friends, the life of my family. I had this anger in my heart. Maybe you know what I'm talking about. You see it, because it's this type of anger that takes very little to emerge. And it can be 0 to 100 just with the flip of a switch, right? And I used that to harm others around me, to get what I wanted, which was the relief I was seeking. And so she comes down the hall and she turns the light on in this room, and I'm hiding behind the door. I can see her through the crack in the door. It's not a large room. She stood there for 30 seconds probably. Felt like an eternity. And she turned the light off and walked down the hall. And it's an important moment for me, not just because of what it means for where I was in my drinking, because it shows me, because I've had a spiritual experience as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that God was doing for me what I could not do for myself long before I knew it. And the number of situations like that, that I came out unscathed, I believe that God was watching or had a plan. And the details, I've said, it doesn't matter as much. You know, I can't try to figure that out. But I know that when I look back, there's something spiritual about nobody getting harmed in those situations, especially none of them getting harmed. And that wasn't the end of that night, actually. I went back to the house and picked a fight with the graduate, of course, in front of all of his friends, and pulled a knife on his best friend and scared the shit out of my family and my sisters, and they were all crying and called the police. And this is what I do when I show up to family events, right? There's a reason that my family started flipping the clothes sign on every time I would come by, right? And it's because I do things like that. And I would act out in ways that might seem bizarre, but the way I would act out was so that you wouldn't get too close, so that you could see what was going on. Because inside, there was a type of suffering. A suffering that came from fear, insecurity. It was the result of lifestyle circumstances, because of decisions I made that were driven by selfishness and self-interest and fear. And anyways, I drove home that night and got pulled over, and it was not a good scene. But the next Monday, my family did an intervention and sent me to rehab, which went over like a lead bullet. It might just be a saying in North Carolina, I don't know. Didn't go well. And didn't go well, because when you corner someone who's afraid of their own shadow, it can get ugly. Broken mirrors, spit in your face, whatever, kick you, punch you. They brought this interventionist in who was very good at his job. And 2 days later, I woke up from a 48-hour blackout in Little Rock, Arkansas, and was checking into a treatment center. And so the process began, right? Because I had been in this treatment center, I stayed 100 days, and I had been there for 30 days, and of course, no problem with alcohol, not me. No problem with anything. The world's my problem, right? But I had been there for about a month, and I did have this strange moment where I realized, okay, I've been here for a month, and all I've thought about is getting out of here so I can get messed up. I'm not saying I have a problem. I'm just saying there's a pattern, okay? But don't be confused what I'm saying. That treatment center was good. I said I stayed 100 days, and it was good for a number of reasons, because they gave me this book. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first thing I wrote in that book was in that treatment center. And I'm not sure when I wrote it. And I actually didn't find it until later, but right there under that stain from tomatoes from last season, it says, "Through my pain, I understand willingness." And pain isn't necessary for change, but it does help propel me, right? And so what I learned in that treatment center, without my, prescription drugs and everything I needed, combined with everything that, I was going to do in addition, a strange thing started to happen, and that's Connor with nothing to hide from Connor. And so what I saw was that I can be equally sick and even in more pain sober than I am drinking. And so when I would go on to get sober at a later time, I was able to look back and see that as much as I wanted my problems to be other people, I wanted my problems to be the situations I was in, my problems originated with me. And I got out of that treatment center, of course, didn't have an addiction issue, but started going to AA meetings because that was what was recommended. And so I was going to a few meetings a day, hanging out at the crack house in between, looking for drywall on the carpets, you know. But, whoa, too much laughter there. If you know, you know, right? So I'm going to a lot of meetings because I actually did like, I remember the first meeting I walked into, it was in Southern Shores, North Carolina. It's my sponsor, Dan D's home group to this day. And Dan, he wasn't always my sponsor, but Dan D is my sponsor now. And there's a solution group on Sunday nights at 8 o'clock. And if you ever find yourself on the Outer Banks of North Carolina at that time, you should go in and punch Dan Dealey in the face and tell him this is from Bill W. for your obviously poor sponsorship and the and your many attempts to kill your sponsees. But I walked into that meeting and I saw what I hadn't seen in a long time, and that was people who claimed to be happy. Because for whatever reason, I wasn't finding those same smiles. And the smile, you know the smile I'm talking about, because I see a lot of them here tonight. I saw a lot of them during the countdown. I think they just rotate from AA meeting to AA meeting that I go to. I saw smiles of people who were genuinely happy, and they came from the heart. And I was interested in that. I wasn't interested in getting sober, but I was interested in being happy. Wasn't interested in working for it, please. But these people weren't anything like me. That was a big problem for me. You know, I was 17. Like I said, I had it hard, harder than anybody's ever had it. And they would obviously not understand that. But I could probably be somewhat happy like them, never as happy as them because I was chronically disadvantaged. But it was enough to keep me coming back, right? It was enough to spark an interest and, you know, go to meetings regularly. And I was picking up chips because I wasn't drinking. I was getting high all the time, but, you know, I was a singleness of purpose kind of guy back then. And so I'm going to meetings all the time, and my life is actually getting back together slowly. The day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous for the last time, was not an extravagant day. Everyone always says, oh, New Year's, you know, did you have a big night? Did you go watch the ball drop or something? No, it was a total coincidence because my life, as I continued to go to meetings and see people who were happy, but I continued to not get that, well, then I'm just screwed, you know? And so my level of happiness continued to decline. Right? My level of contentedness continued to decline. And those horsemen that I talk about, right? Those things I felt the day I woke up after Tyler and I drank the Jose Cuervo, that shame and remorse of the next day where I wake up and I kind of wish I hadn't. Where I wake up and I wish maybe it had all been a dream, and that everything was going to be okay, and that today was going to be a fresh start, those were becoming so regular in my life. The bedevilments were afflicting me. And I didn't understand why, because I was going to meetings, and I was sober. And that would continue to, I clearly don't mean sober in that situation if you're new, but that would continue to drag me to a point of desperation where I could no longer, just like our friend Joe. You know, Joe was 23 years old when he killed himself. Just like Joe, I could no longer go on drinking and I could no longer go on not drinking. I had reached a turning point, as it talks about in this book, once again. I remember when I read this book for the first time. Although I had not been relating in, I didn't feel the same as those around me in meetings. I couldn't deny that I overwhelmingly identified with the words that were in this book. And so I reached a turning point. I went to a meeting, of course, and I might have been a couple days dry. And I called Ken, who was my first sponsor, and Ken had come up to me in that October meeting, which is great because he's selfish and never does this. He had come up to me in that October meeting, more God timing, and he gave me his number and he said, call me. And I had actually been talking with Ken semi-regularly, about as much as someone who was in my state would want to talk to Ken. But I called Ken that night. I just walked out of a meeting. I'd stood him up on some step work not long ago because I was high. And those two don't mix well. And and I told him, Ken, I got to be honest with you. I make it sound a lot cooler. I was bawling my eyes out. I'm like, Ken, I'm dying. I don't know what to do. Like, just help. Just help. I don't have the words. Just help, man. By the way, I haven't been sober this whole time I've known you. He's like, you think I didn't know that? But so Ken, he told me exactly what I needed to hear. He said, Connor, go home. This was at like 9 o'clock at night. Go home. Don't drink. I'll see you at the 7:30 morning meeting tomorrow. Pick up a white chip. We'll talk tomorrow. And I did. I went. My vice principal was there. My former vice principal, she gave me my white chip. I cried on her shoulder for the next 20 minutes. And recovery began. At least I wasn't drinking anymore. That was the last time. And I was beat down to a point of, you know, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I always thought that the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization talked about the material things. It talked about being homeless, you know, being estranged from your family, not having a job, being unemployable, having no friends, you know, no one likes you. Well, it's not that no one likes me, it's that I screw over everybody I'm around, so people genuinely don't want to be around me, right? So I thought those were all my problems. And then I went to rehab and got rid of some of those problems. I had some money in my pocket, was holding down a job, you know, was trying to repair some relationships with my family. And so the material things in my life were getting better. And I thought that, you know, my life previously had been bad because I was in and out of jail. The cops discriminated against me, right? Because, I mean, look at me. Why wouldn't you discriminate against me, right? And, you know, I was just a natural victim. But what I found is, you know, my material things started to come back, and I continued to get worse, and I continued to degrade, and my standards continued to go lower and lower, and eventually my standards went lower faster than I could lower my standards. And that's the suffering that brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't any one event. There was plenty of events. There was plenty of fights. There was a broken nose or two. There was broken knuckles, there was arrest, there was, you know, pissing yourself in bed, whatever. You know, all the embarrassing things, I know, right? There's a man who's done it. None of those things were my problem. Connor was my problem, and he was catching up. And so I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you told me, don't drink or use no matter what. And I really didn't know what you were talking about because I'm the opposite. I drink and I use no matter what. Right? Because that's my solution to life. That was the skill set I had spent the last 17 years developing. It was the only thing I had to show for it. It was an ability to chronically deflect attention, keep you at an arm's distance, keep you from getting to know the scared and broken person that I truly was. Because I've heard it said that to be loved but not known is the ultimate suffering. And what I've found is in Alcoholics Anonymous, I can be known and loved. But being known and not loved was always my biggest fear, is that I would tell you who I really was. You would find out who I was. And you'd turn your back on me. You wouldn't like me. You'd continue to break the scared little boy who was living within me. And so I needed a solution when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had been coming to meetings long enough that I at least knew that there was a solution. I didn't work any steps, but I knew they existed, right? I didn't chair any meetings, but I went to a lot of them, right? I didn't do any service, but I used a lot of people's service work. And so what it meant to enter recovery, what it meant to pick up that white chip that last time, do y'all have white chips out here? Is that an, okay, is that, I didn't know, it's different everywhere, sorry. What it meant for me was that something had to be different. And it didn't just mean not going to the trap house in between meetings. It meant that I had to make some fundamental changes in the way I lived my life. The problem is I didn't know how to do that. I still had the maturity of that 12-year-old that I talked about, and that wasn't very high for a 12-year-old. And so I had a sponsor, and right away we got into the steps. We got into this thing called the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I heard it talked about the three legacies today. Thank you to all the panelists who came. Thank you to everyone who showed up. But I heard some amazing things this weekend. And I've heard a lot of solution this weekend. And if you're wondering, if you're sitting here wondering how it is that there's a room full of people dancing and cheering and picking Billy up off of his chair while he screams he loves you to Kayla. And if you're wondering how you get that, talk to some of those people with the heartfelt smiles that you're going to see around the room. Because there is a solution. And like it says in this book, it's vastly more than a sufficient substitute. It's not just, I'm going to stop drinking and my life's going to be. It's, I'm going to stop drinking, get in the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life's going to be beyond my wildest dreams. Because if you had let me tell you what I wanted out of life and out of sobriety on the first day I walked in, I would have sold myself way short. It's a cliche for you, right? But it's true. And I have a lot of good material things in my life today. But the most important thing I have in my life is principles, like we heard talked about last night. It's things happening not around me, but inside of me, right? And it's the ability to use those when things happen around me to change what's going on inside of me. Or to look at it with a new pair of glasses, provided free of charge from Alcoholics Anonymous. Work for it later. Your debt's greater than ever. So I came in and, you know, Ken said, go to a meeting every day, 90 meetings in 90 days, which I think originated with treatment centers, but that's what he had me do. And he said, get two men's numbers at every meeting you go to, and the next day you're going to call those two men, and you're going to do the same thing the next day and the day after. And you're going to start looking for people. You have 2 weeks? Look for the guy who has 13 days. And he said, notice I said guy who has 13 days coming. And I was so desperate and hurting so bad inside that I was willing to try what you were doing. I was 2 feet in from the first day, and I've tried to remain that way every day of my sobriety. And there's been suffering, and there's been pain in sobriety. Because sometimes things happen that you don't see coming, right? A friend relapses and dies. A friend who doesn't relapse kills himself, right? And there's good things, too. You know, when Tamara was talking last night, I cried when she told that story about showing up for her aunt. You know why? Because today I can show up and be reliable. And when someone calls me, I know in my heart of hearts that the person on the end of that phone knows that if they need something from me, whether it's life or death or just, you know, a little favor, whatever, they know I'm going to show up and do life today. Because that's how I roll. That's how I was taught to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what it means to show up and be a part of. Because I can't just take. Like I spent so much of my life doing. I can't just be the person on the other end of that phone needing something. I spent a long time needing a lot. Eventually people stopped answering. You know, things happen that hurt. They hurt our hearts. They hurt our souls, our emotions. My dog died like 6 weeks ago, and it really ripped me up because I got her when I went to that rehab that I was talking about, right? And so I get to show up and be a part of and like feel that and grieve it and move on. You know what I mean? And then next month, my dad's getting married, and I get to be one of his two groomsmen. What a blessing. Because 6 years ago, I wouldn't have gotten the invite. I wouldn't be there. And if I did get the invite, I wouldn't show. And if I did show, I would fucking ruin it. Right? Yeah. Which is why I wasn't getting the invite to start with. And it's this cycle, and it's pour me another drink. Right? So I got into the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous right away. There was this young people's group in Norfolk, Virginia, which was about 90 minutes from where I was getting sober, and this guy I became good friends with, I mentioned him, he would eventually become my sponsor, Dan, who is everything I wasn't. He was 74, he was smart, he was had it together, he was, you know, just polar opposite, gay, you know. Retired, living life large. I'm like, you know, barely getting by. He's like, well, let's go. Let's go to the, I'm like, Dan, you're 74. You're going to come to the young people's meeting? But Dan got sober at Garden State Young People's in New York. And he's been sober much longer than I've been alive. And he's also been one of my best friends for about a quarter of my life now. And it's funny how this common denominator, this alcoholism and recovery from that alcoholism, can bring people like Dan and I together for a long-term, mutually beneficial relationship where we both get to live the life we always dreamed of. And so we went to this meeting, and it was, oh my gosh, it was fire. There was no young people where I was living getting sober, you know? And so there goes another one of my reasons to feel bad for myself, because now I'm around a bunch of young people who are sober. And but I loved that meeting. Every Thursday at 8 o'clock, that meeting still meets. I went to it the night before I came, before I flew out to come here. And it set me on fire for Young People's Alcoholics Anonymous. It set me on fire for the general service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous. It inspired me to start a young people's group where I was living. You don't have the solution you need, create it, right? Stop bitching about it and do something about it. And most importantly, it was one of the pivotal moments of my new sobriety. I was leaving that meeting, and I had been lying to Dan for a while about my age. I told him I was 18. I didn't know if there was this age requirement here. I didn't know. And I'd gotten a ticket, and I'm bitching about it, of course, because that's what I did. Poor me. And he's reading it. He says, Connor, this says 94. That would make you 17. I said, you would be correct. And we're talking about something, and I accidentally let my filter slip because I was still pretty guarded. I had like 2 months at this time. And I let my filter down, and he said, wow, you really are one of us. You're crazy. And I remember where we were on the interstate when he said that, because it was like sliding into home base. To be known and loved. I just showed you who I really was, and you took me for it. With a smile on your face. And I remember the exact moment where we were, and it was like, whew, I can breathe. And in a lot of ways, that was the moment I truly joined Alcoholics Anonymous, because without that, I wouldn't have been able to get honest about a number of things that I had to get honest about in order to achieve continuous sobriety. So Dan and I, you know, we started working together eventually, sponsorship, and I should say that there's this thing about love. I heard it talked about in one of the panels today. And the meeting I went to Thursday night before I came here was about love. The speaker was talking about love and what it means to love. And he said, love for others means trying my best to lose my selfishness. It means trying my best to lose self, right? I heard it said today, love is an action, and that what I put in the world will reciprocate. And when I put love into my relationships and my friendships and my career and my schoolwork and my step work, those things reciprocate and multiply. But when I put selfishness, I put character defects, I fail to look at myself, and I put that into the world, it will also reciprocate and it will also multiply. So what's your solution today, Connor? Choose one. Because to drink is to die for me today, right? So I went to that first meeting, and it really lit me up for Young People's AA, and I was really getting involved in AA at this time. And there was a Young People's Conference called the Virginia State Conference of Young People's in AA. I'll be at it next weekend. And I had about 5 months sober, still not quite spiritually right. Got my nipples pierced at that conference. Right. Let's make sure this tape doesn't get out of here. You know, don't use my last name on that. And I went to that conference. Hey, catch me after. So I went to that conference, and I was surrounded by people who look a lot like you do tonight. And I saw this woman up on the stage, and she'd been sober 7 years, which was unfathomable to me. 7 years ago, I was 10 years old, right? Hadn't even started drinking yet. And she got up there and she told her story. And I think that was the first time I cried for someone else, maybe in my entire life. Definitely in my sobriety. I did a lot of crying. It was always about me, right? But today, you know, that's a common denominator. Is I get to show up and grieve with people. I get to show up and take them for where they're at in their most vulnerable places and not judge them for it and not put any title on it and just show up. It's this. So I'm a law clerk, which requires you to have opinions. And so sometimes in my professional life, I'm just like, weird, when I should be like, that's illegal. You know? But AA has taught me open-mindedness, and it's taught me to take people for where they're at. Because people consistently take me for where I'm at. And that weekend went by, and it might have been the 2 hours of sleep I got the entirety of my time there. It might have been the 26 Red Bulls I drank in 48 hours. It might have been all the beautiful women that I was prepared to make my higher power in the room. But I called Ken Sunday afternoon and spoke about 1,000 words a minute to him. Blah, 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 Ken, blah, blah, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Blah, 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 blah. I love Young People's AA. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And the fire was lit. And so I had been working some steps, but I really got in the solution at that time. I was 5 months sober. If you've never been to the Outer Banks of North Carolina in the summer, then you won't understand why I've continued to go back there every summer, even after, well, most summers, even after moving to Colorado. I've lived there for 4 years. By God's grace, I graduated college last month. And yeah. Woo! I graduated college as a respected member of the community, as the student body president of my school, as someone who was accepted to law school with a full ride scholarship. And these are things, you know, I'm going to go back Monday, I'm going to be in court, I'm going to go collect rent from tenants. I'm going to do a number of things consistently every day that I never had in my life, right? And so the material is back in my life, but the reason I have those things is because I dove into Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Not just diving into steps, but diving into service of others. Even when I'm not going to get to stand up on a stage and have everyone look at me, because this is my preferred means of service right here, you know? But cleaning cigarette trays isn't as sexy. But how far are you willing to go to stay sober? And that was a question that the sponsorship in my life consistently challenged me to answer in a positive way. And like I said, everything I put in the world reciprocates. And it has to be driven by love for me today. You know, sometimes it can be selfish love. I love my life today. I've found a solution that consistently works in my life today. I don't want to mess it up. I'm going to do the same thing that has worked for the last 2,001 days. Yesterday, my phone ticked, and it was like, you have 2,000 days of sobriety, or something. You've been sober 2,000 days, something. I've got this app. Anyways, what I've done, and it hasn't failed me, even in the hard times, right? So when I have a choice today, when I get out of bed, am I going to hit my knees? I got five readings. They're written right here. I wrote those with about 60 days of sobriety. Page 63, page 76, page 85, pages 86 through 88, page 100, page 417. Am I going to read them? Am I going to set myself on a spiritual path today? So that when that guy cuts me off when I'm driving to work, I can say, have a great day. And not get out of the car, tell him I'm going to kick his ass. You know? Because the second one, while it's just we are not saints, right? While it's just this excuse of bad behavior that I might use occasionally, that can take me in a very dark way. And the more I do that is not in line with my spiritual fitness, the easier it is for me to justify the next thing I do that is a little more sketchy. That's a little less honest, right? Well, you know, I lied to that, you know, lied to that girl about how old I was, and she seemed into it, and it was fine. You know, it's probably okay to lie about my experience on my resume, right? And then you can see where the chain of events goes, right? Because rationalization and justification, those are, in addition to drinking, the skill set I had developed in 17 years, you know, as well as feeling bad for myself, but that came natural. I didn't have to develop that. So this might be the 10th time I've said this, but I dove into the program Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And, you know, I could take you through one by one, but the fact is the steps are the steps. And find a sponsor that is the right fit for you. But if you can't find one, maybe you're the problem. Get a sponsor, work the steps. And if things aren't working out, if you don't think things are going well, maybe try a different sponsor. You know what I mean? I have to be malleable and I have to be able to adapt if my recovery is going to survive. It talks about in this book, life will ebb and flow. I will have good days. I will have bad days. And some days the bad days are just like really bad, you know? I'm going to tell a story. I was sober. I was sober about 2 years. And my brother, maybe 3 years, because I was home from college for the summer. And my brother was not doing well. Remember I said he never graduated from college? Well, he went to college on a full-ride scholarship, playing football, and he drank himself out of several of those. And, you know, he continues to lower his standards. And I've had to, for my own safety and my own health and wellness, say, cut the codependent bullshit with my family, right? And he's part of that for me. And I see him, and I'm going to Virginia Beach on business, which is where he lives. It's like an hour from where I'm living, and I'm like, let's get dinner. He's like, okay, I'm in between houses, by the way. AKA, I'm fucking homeless. I'm like, great, let's still get dinner. I'm not getting you a hotel room. Boundaries. I'm not getting you a hotel room. You got problems with your living situation? Not my problem, brother. You know what I mean? You can't just call and call and need and need. Like, I get the game you're playing. I played it for a long time. I'll buy you dinner. I'd love to be around you. Love you, man. Not going to take you home with me, you know? So the night goes on, and we have dinner or whatever, and, you know, I knew it was going to happen. I don't know why I subject myself to these situations. I knew he was going to ask me to get him a hotel room, even though I said no, right? And I told him no, and we're sitting there in the Hardee's parking lot, and he's got nothing to his name, no belongings, nothing, no money to go get a hotel room. He says he's been sleeping on the beach, eating fish. He's got a flair for the dramatic. I don't know about the eating fish part, but I believe he didn't have a house, at least, right? So I can recognize those stories I used to tell him. I said used to, so I'm very, you know, not guilty anymore, but and he's crying, man, and he's like, just like, you know, ugly face crying like that. It was bad, right? I'm laughing about it. It's messed up. You're laughing at his suffering? Ouch. No, I'm just, so he asked me to get him a hotel room, and I have to sit there in those moments with no vice, no way to get out of me, and ask myself questions about who I am, what's important to me, my spirituality. Is it okay for me to let someone suffer knowingly, right? Is it okay for me to know that he's, you know, could go out there at night, put a needle in his arm, and this will be the last time I ever saw him, was crying in the parking lot of Hardee's? That's the reality. That's the reality for people like us. You know, my mom just told me a few days ago, he was going up to a doctor's appointment in the big city. I'm like, dude's never scheduled a doctor's appointment on his own in his life. He has no money. What do you think he's really doing in the big city, you know? I've been to the big city before. And she hadn't heard from him for like 3 or 4 days since that's what he told her. And she doesn't know if he's dead, right? That's the kind of stuff that I put my family through consistently. And in sobriety, those things don't stop happening in my life. I got him a hotel room. I was weak. But... but the choice for me is to elevate my spiritual life or die. You know, it's very simple. This is a spiritual solution. So as I stayed sober, I think what I continued to learn and what's continued to prove itself to me repeatedly is that, you know, it's not about how much I drank. It's not about what you did to earn your seat here. For me, it's about the person I am when I'm not drinking. And in sobriety, it's about doing things that aren't always convenient for me, that aren't always comfortable for me, and that in some ways will make me temporarily suffer. Because growing for me is suffering. But it's about doing those things so that I can stay sober. So I told the young people's story. I talked about the conference, and I want to talk about some amends and maybe a little bit about what my life's like now, you know. And so I knew before I moved to Colorado. I lived in Colorado for 4 years. You know, and I'm just moving out. And I knew that before I did that, I needed to get a lot of these amends done. And that some of them were going to challenge me. Now, I don't have any dramatic story about what happened. And, you know, there was difficult ones. There's ones I still haven't made that someone reminded me today of. And it's about, for me, a level of ownership of my actions that says, you know, not just I'm sorry. What can I do to make it better? For me, it's about not just making a commitment to that person, it's about making a commitment to myself that I'm going to go out of my way to not do things like this in the future. Because I know where they took me. They took me to a broken down, homeless, scared, violent, angry shell of a human. And so when I sit down with people who I think have wronged me, you know, people like my dad, people who aren't heavy on the emotional stuff, right? You want to talk to people, you know, make an amends to an attorney who doesn't work a spiritual program. It's like speaking a foreign language to them, you know? But I still have to show up and do those things because it's not about them. It's about what I've done, and it's about me. And the last story I'm going to tell is about, you know, I said spiritual experience. Well, I always had this problem with God, you know? Or maybe God had a problem with me, as, you know, I like to think of it at that time. So I was sober, and my life was getting good, and I was in service. I was doing meetings regularly, had some time sober. And Dan flies to Colorado after the first season I lived out there as a ski bum. This was before I started college, so this was 2013. And we're driving back, and we wanted to do this road trip where we stopped and saw all of these national parks. You know, I like to do outdoor things. That's why being sober for me means getting up and moving to Colorado and getting uncomfortable and being bold to live my dreams, right? And so we're driving back and we're doing the national park tour, and our end destination is this monastery in Kentucky. And we spoke tonight, and I like to think it's God, that he's checking into that same monastery tomorrow for a retreat that he takes every year. And I'm moving to Kentucky later this year. And so I never know what God is working on, but I trust that God is working in my life. I don't know what that's about. Is it odd or is it God? I don't know. I'm an odd guy, so sometimes I can't tell these things. And we're driving through the byway in Utah, and having a flair for the dramatic, I stopped the car, or no, we're driving, didn't stop the car yet, and I told Dan, you know, I don't believe in God. And I was taking a leap of faith that it's better to be, that I need to try to be known, right, and risk that I won't be loved, because I had this fear. I was sober about 18 months, and I had this fear that if I ever questioned or showed any weakness in my sobriety was therefore threatened. Right? That the shell would be cracked, and ultimately that would make it easier to break the egg. What I found was that risking cracking the shell makes the egg stronger for me. Right? And I told Dan, you know, I don't believe in God. And then I pulled over, and then it became a dramatic scene where I get out of the car and I'm like having this emotional moment on the side of the Route 12 byway in Utah in the middle of friggin' nowhere. And Dan's like, what? What? I'm like, roll with me, Dan. I'm having a moment. So I don't believe in God, and so for some reason I was afraid that my sobriety was lesser than if I got honest about that, because I wanted this thing more than I could put into words, and I was willing to go to any length to try and keep it. But I was afraid that if I showed some sort of weakness, that I was going to lose it. And what I found is I had to get honest about that if I ever wanted to find God. And anyways, Dan, he didn't make a big deal of it. He said, I'm just a bit confused. Why did you agree to go to the monastery for a retreat if you don't believe in God? It's not that big of a deal to me. I'm just confused. You know, it's that like shame and like trying to please others thing. I don't know, Dan. So we go to the monastery. It was great. It was beautiful. We did a fifth step out there. And that was what I think was the beginning of a spiritual experience that it talks about in this book. And it talks about in the book, we have found much heaven, We've been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, of which we had not even dreamed. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. And so that was a monastery from the Cistercian order, which is based out of Rome. And it was a nice weekend, a little bit much on the quiet for what was going on in my head at 18 months, but it was still nice. And we got back, and this cousin got in touch with me, who was a monk in South America in the Cistercian order. He said he was coming to the States, and he'd like to meet me. He said, "Connor, I'm going to die, and I'd like to meet you before I do." And so he came to the Outer Banks. We met. He stayed for a few days. He left. And then he followed up with me, and he said, "Connor, I'd like for you to come down to South America and visit the monastery." He was fascinated about the 12 steps. He was fascinated about my life in Alcoholics Anonymous because he had studied, I don't know, the guy, they don't really work. They live in this place, and they're quiet all the time, and he basically reads. But he knew all about Alcoholics Anonymous, and he told me that he thinks the principles that I'm trying to live by are very much in line with the principles that he tries to live by as a monk in the Cistercian order. And he'd love for me to come down to South America. And so I go down to South America, and it's my first time traveling out of the country, I think ever. Definitely sober. But so I go down there, and I spent like 6 weeks working with the chronically underprivileged in South America, working in these favelas, and, you know, really gaining a new perspective, like the book just talked about, is that I'll have a new perspective towards God's universe. And one day after work, so they do work, they don't work like we work, but they work. And one day I was back in, so I was staying in the monks' quarters because I'm family, so they have a retreat house, but I was staying inside the monastery, and I'm back there, and, you know, I think I was reading this book. I took this book with me. I just got back from Europe. I was there studying abroad and took this book with me, and this book has traveled more than I traveled my entire life before getting sober. And, you know, I'm sitting in the room, and I just started bawling and felt like I had this out-of-body experience. And I knew, you know, because of the things I had seen and the perspective I had gained, I knew that God had been with me. And like I said earlier, God was watching my life at the times I didn't know it, when I was drinking, when I was a kid and bad things happened to me, right? Or when I was a drunk and I did bad things to other people and I got away with things I shouldn't have gotten away with. Or when I was sober and I was suffering because I was lacking a spiritual solution, even though I was doing everything you were telling me to do. I was still suffering. And in that moment, I was able to see how God had worked in my life from the beginning. And that my problem was I was hung up on my conception of God. And it was like hearing a voice. I'm making this like a burning bush story, and I don't want to do that. But it was like having this moment of realization where God's just saying to me, "Yeah, I've been here. I got you. I'm here." And it was like the answer. It was like that prayer I did at the very beginning. God, help me. You know, and sometimes that's how simple my relationship with God has to be. And I came back from that trip, and, you know, my sobriety had been full of ups and downs. Anybody else ever had that? Like, you know, like peaking one day and bottoming out the next in sobriety. And, you know, that had been like my entire sobriety. Maybe it wasn't day to day. Maybe it'd become like week to week. But I was still like up and down. And from that moment on, I've never had these peaks or these valleys. I've been even. Because I feel like I've got a spiritual toolkit that I gain through a number of things that come with the life I live. It comes with practicing prayer and meditation regularly. It comes with doing things like a 10th step so I can promptly admit my wrongs and not allow them to continue to harm me, right? I can take care of it then. Like, I don't have to make a movie out of a commercial. You know what I mean? Like, leave it where it's at. And I can reach out to people today, just like was done for me, and say, I know how you feel. I know you don't look at me and think I've ever felt like you feel right now, right? Because, you know, I think men, especially alcoholic men, are complex creatures, and there's like a lot of things working, but just trust me, I've been where you're at, bro, you know? And, bro, and, you know, I do things like I work out, I eat well, I get up on time, I make my bed, I read. I don't just read this book, I read. You know what I mean? I have a well-rounded solution for living today. And where that all started was from working the 12 steps and taking suggestions as they were recommended to me in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And by a sponsor and by the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my experience has been the closer I am to the center of the ship, the less apt I am to fall off the side. And so when I do cool things, like go to South America, it's still a priority for me to get to meetings. You know what I mean? I'm talking with Anna from Des Moines earlier this weekend. I'm talking with her yesterday, and she's telling me how she was in Spain studying abroad and going to meetings and hanging out with people. And I'm like, are you kidding me? This is the life we get to live, right? And there was a time I didn't know that any of this existed. And if it did, I could never have it because I'm chronically disadvantaged. You know, like the world works against me, man. You just wouldn't understand because you're not me. And so I get to live this life. And recently, so I was flying back from Prague Saturday. A week ago this time, I was flying back from Prague. And let's 12-step this man, huh? Someone's sick and suffering. That's the call of complex creatures. So I'm flying back. So I'm flying back, and I'm looking out the window, and the sun's setting, and we're right on the corner of Canada. I can see it on the map. It's a place called Nova Scotia. And I look out, and having a flair for the dramatic, I just had this thought. I'm like, you know, the plane could crash right now and I could die and I would be happy. I'd be happy with what I've done with my life. I'd be happy with where I was. And there was this sense of contentment in that thought, right? That I don't need. The closer I am to a spiritual program, the more I'm calling my sponsor every day and picking up the phone when my sponsor... 7 o'clock this morning. 7 a.m. He knew I was at a conference, and he's calling. Sponsees, that's what I'm talking about. I'm like, Casey, you got to be kidding me right now. And I pick up the phone anyways, when I don't want to, right? I was up till 3 o'clock last night, and then Casey's calling at 7 o'clock, and he's got like 2 months, and he's sick and suffering, and Dan's in the, you know, some girl. I don't know. I was still kind of tired, but it's like... Been there, brother. But I pick up that phone today, you know what I mean? And the more in line I am with those things, the less apt I am to have those bedevilments, you know, those horsemen come back and haunt me, the bewilderment, the terror, the fear, the insecurities. You know, the further the principles get away from my life, the worse my life gets. It's like a perfect correlation. And the more I don't do those things, the more that I can be restless and irritable and discontented in my own sobriety. And I don't want to be one of those people who, you know, I was sober 5 years and now here I am. And I'm back to square zero. And if that's where you are, that's where you are. You know what I mean? Like, you can always move forward from here if you stop moving back, right? I had a pretty long relationship in sobriety, which I didn't have any relationships for 18 months, and I stayed sober, and my life was much better because of it. I'm not lecturing, I'm just sharing my experience. And, you know, I had this relationship that I got in when I was about 3 years sober, and it lasted about a year and a half. And her dad was 21 years sober, and he started drinking again. Yeah, and he's still drinking. And it was kind of scary to talk to her and understand what she was going through and understand that that's what I put my people through. You know what I mean? To understand that until he kills someone or gets a DUI or, you know, the awful things that happened when he was 21 years old when he got sober, until that happens again, that's probably going to be where he's at or worse, right? And the thing for me is I'm sober today, which means I have to take action today. And if I want to have a good life today, I need to continue to take that action. And as in control my life is today, as even as my emotions and my situations and everything is, if I pick up a drink, I don't know where I'm going. I don't know when it'll stop. My experience is that obsession, both physical and mental, is not something that I can overcome on willpower alone. And so it's a very dangerous game for me to play, trying to stay sober today on yesterday's sobriety. And I just want to read this prayer. I think I'm done talking, but there's this prayer that, it's a miracle, I'm done talking. There's this prayer that I want to read because I think it sums up how I'm trying to live my life. You know, my Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not know the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end. Nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore, I will trust you always. Though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death, I will not fear. For you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone. For so long, I had to face my perils alone. And from the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had to do that. And if I did do it, it was by choice. I don't know what I'm doing. Sometimes I make decisions that were not the right decision, they weren't God-guided, and I suffer the consequences, and I get to choose when I suffer those consequences, what's the next decision going to be? The next right indicated thing is what I need to do. What's right in front of me? It's very simple. Should I do this? Should I not do this? Is this love-driven? Is this going to help others? Is this self-driven? Is this going to harm others? Right? And when I get off that road, it doesn't mean that God has abandoned me or that I am some lesser than because I've failed some spiritual test, okay? It means that I need to do everything I can to get back on that road. I'm grateful to the program Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful to this committee. And I'm grateful for this book, for the steps, and for my higher power, and I'm grateful for all of you being here. I love you. Have a great time this weekend. Thanks.